You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his review in The New Yorker, James Wood described Rachel Kushner's second novel, The Flamethrowers, as scintillatingly alive and also alive to artifice. It ripples with stories, anecdotes, set pieces, monologues, crafty, egotistical tall tales, and hapless adventures. It's the story of a young artist nicknamed Reno who comes to New York City's Soho in the 1970s to be an artist and winds up part of an underground radical political movement in Rome. The Flamethrowers is published by Scribner, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Rachel Kushner to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So can you describe Reno? What kind of person is she?
Well, she's young. She's 22 when she moves to New York City, and she's from Reno and actually is never named in the novel, but once or twice another character somewhat sarcastically refers to her as Reno. And the name has just stuck when it comes to talk about the book.
And it stuck for you, too.
In a way, it did. But I consider her nameless, actually. She never reveals her name. She speaks in the first person. I wanted the reading experience to be very tightly bound to her perceptions and impressions. She's a bit wide-eyed when she moves to New York. She wants to become an artist. She's slightly naive or just unversed in the kind of ways of the people that she meets in this Soho milieu.
Well, Soho was an area in transition at the time, and art was somewhat in transition at the time.
Yes, indeed.
And she's somebody who wants to be part of the new thing.
Yes, she wants to be part of the new thing. She's not uneducated. She has a degree in art. She's interested in land art. She has some sense of what a conceptual practice involves. And she moves to New York at a time when people are shifting from making discrete objects to the gesture, the performance, something that can be much more sly, this sort of transition from art into life and vice versa.
Well, a number of the things in this novel come out of your own life experience, especially all of the stuff about motorcycles. But what about art? Did you have to do a lot of research?
No, I didn't do any research, really. I mean, in a way I did and in a way I didn't. I've always been interested in contemporary art, even since I was a child. And though I wanted to be a fiction writer, when I moved to New York, I sort of fell in socially much more with artists than I ever did with writers. And though not totally qualified, I began writing pieces of art criticism for Art Forum. And that really gave me a wonderful crash course education in the art world. And to talk about contemporary art today, you have to have really immersed yourself in the discourse of the 1970s and the major figures of that era and their ideas, et cetera. So I drew upon, I guess, you know, a storehouse of knowledge that I had just built up over many years.
The 70s are when Duchamp suddenly became the most influential artist after years of people debating over whether it was Picasso or Matisse. And we do see a major shift in the way art is being made. In this case, she's involved with motorcycles, and that's part of what she's doing.
She has a history riding motorcycles, and when she moves to New York, she is exposed more to the practices of land art. And you know, in real life, there were people at the time like Robert Longo, Robert Smithson, and Michael Heiser who were making these projects across large pieces of land in the West. And she gets the idea to ride a motorcycle on the Bonneville Salt Flats and photograph her traces.
And you've done something similar? You've had a crash?
Well, I haven't done something similar in the sense that I'm not an artist, and I never rode motorcycles as a kind of aesthetic gesture.
To set a record.
Yeah. Well, I didn't do it as art, and I've never ridden on the Bonneville Salt Flats, but I did spend a pretty large amount of time in my 20s riding motorcycles, and I did a little bit of racing, and I've ridden on dry lake beds just for fun in Mexico, and it's a strange experience because you don't really have good traction. And I did once crash going almost 140 miles an hour.
Like Reno crashes, although she's going faster at the time. Along with Reno's story, you also tell the story of Valera, an Italian motorcycle designer in the first part of the 20th century. How does he fit into the story?
Well, yes, Valera actually opens the book, so I consider him to be quite a central character, even if his story and him as a figure only appear intermittently. He is something of a futurist. He's Italian and is a kind of falls in with this little gang of avant-garde scofflaws in a way in Rome, and they make a world that is as sort of it reveres speed and violence and the machine age, and he ends up founding a motorcycle company that also eventually gets into the rubber business and makes tires. And his son becomes an artist and moves to New York City. And the narrator, sometimes referred to as Reno, ends up dating the son.
Now, the futurists were also involved with politics. Most of them supported Mussolini. And this book is
later.
Also... yes, but this book is also about politics. And one reviewer suggested it could be seen as a contemporary rewriting of Flaubert's novel Sentimental Education about revolutionary times.
Right. That was James Wood who said that.
Did you see that?
In a way, yes. I mean, I don't know. I mean, the politics in the book can be read various ways. There are people who've read the book that think it's an allegory of our own time. It depends on how you look at it. There's a certain thread and some ideas about revolt in the book. And as I was writing it, the Occupy movement happened and the Arab Spring happened and the anti-austerity movements in Europe and in Greece. So there were people who thought that I was sort of, you know, referring to that. In terms of the futurist, I was interested in the moment really before they aligned themselves with Mussolini and became the aesthetic propagandistic wing of a fascist government. There's a moment more like 1909, many years before all of that, when they were quite a radical group.
In fact, Marinetti used to read poetry with the Dadaists in Zurich. So
right. Well, you know, he was really had a French education, and I think French might have even been his first language. And yeah, he was very interested in poetry.
So Reno winds up going from Soho to Rome.
Yes.
At a time of great political ferment. This is when radicals are kneecapping prime ministers and kidnapping politicians.
Right. Well, I think it was more the fascists that were doing most of the kneecapping. But there were the Red Brigades, who were, you know, a clandestine Leninist group who engaged in quite a bit of violence. But then there was a much larger, very loose grouping all over the country of people who were not behaving in a clandestine manner or engaging really in violence, but openly using a kind of illegality to protest against the government, and they were the autonomous of Italy.
My guess is Rachel Kushner's latest novel is The Flamethrowers. She was nominated for the National Book Award for her previous novel, her first one called Telex from Cuba. The cover has a picture of a young woman with tape over her mouth.
Yeah.
Is Reno prevented from telling the story? She's somewhat of an unreliable narrator, isn't she?
Well, I don't consider her to be an unreliable narrator, although I'm not quite sure in what sense you mean it.
I'm not always – she takes a strange position, often very cool, distance bystander. Way of seeing the world, rather than ever talking about how involved she feels on a personal, emotional level.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, when I hear the term unreliable narrator, I presume it means something to the effect that the narrator is not forthcoming or is using some kind of dissimulation. And I think that she is truthful and, as I said, wide-eyed and trying to describe the things around her as she sees them. But she can be somewhat unknowing and unversed to the ways of, and the maneuvers of the people around her. She maybe is slightly naive on occasion. I don't think it makes her unreliable. In terms of the cover, that picture is of a woman, one of the Italian autonomous, probably part of this group, the Metropolitan Indians, who painted their faces. And The photograph had tape over it on the cover of an underground magazine after a feminist radio station was raided and bombed. So I think it was meant to symbolize a sort of censorship. And my narrator, though not censored, is overrun a lot of the time by people who speak more easily and more loudly.
Are the Valera family and their factories based on real Italian manufacturers?
Well, in a way, yes. I was interested in rubber, and I was thinking about it in the way that it had been utilized as a material by artists in the 70s, which seemed like a kind of swan song to the industrial age. And then I started looking into the rubber manufacturers in Italy, most famously Pirelli, and discovered that that was where the Red Brigades got their start, was on the shop floor of the Pirelli factories. And it seemed like a kind of wonderful coincidence that indicated me in what direction I should go.
You chose to call the book The Flamethrowers. We're talking about flamethrowers of all sorts of types. Artists who are flamethrowers, people on the left, anarchists, people on the right.
Yeah, or maybe even just raconteurs who are throwing out a, you know, fiery dissimulation or lie of some kind. I mean, it's meant to be a little bit open-ended. Most distinctly, it does refer to a regiment in World War I in Italy.
Well, the Red Brigades threw Molotov cocktails.
Yes, they did.
So you were there at the time of this political ferment? Are you drawing
Me?
From your own personal experiences?
No, you
were in Italy in the 1990s when the country has kind of settled down into something else.
Yeah, no, I never went to Europe growing up. I would have been a very young child then. I wish I would have been there. But I didn't go to Europe until I was in college. And by the time I got there, exactly as you say, things had settled into something else. But more recently, maybe around the time I started writing this book, 2007, 2008, I started learning.
Immediately after you'd finished? The previous
one? Yeah. I knew I wanted to write a book that took place in the 1970s and in New York and using the downtown art world as a milieu. And then I started learning about autonomia because my husband has written some theoretical texts about it. And we knew some people who are associated with that movement. And the more I learned going to Italy, speaking to people, the more it seemed like a really fantastic context for fiction.
And the idea of writing historical fiction, even if the period we're talking about isn't all that long ago, is that appeal to you particularly?
Well, it's funny. I recoil a tiny bit from the term historical fiction, and maybe there's some kind of snobbery there, is that it suggests a genre, and I consider myself to be a writer, period, and not a writer who attaches to a genre.
I just meant a book that takes place in an earlier time.
Yeah, sure. No, I know what you're saying. And I mean, in a way, obviously, it must, because both of my novels have taken place in earlier times. I think that I have enjoyed the tool of hindsight when you can see around a time and look at theoretical causes and certain historical antecedents. And it gives me much more to work with because I do like kind of the big ideas. They're fun for me. But I'm actually working on a contemporary novel now. So,
you have gotten fabulous reviews for this book. Were nominated for the National Book Award for your previous novel. I mean, where do you go from here, the Nobel? Robert Stone gave you a blurb, one of the most brilliant writers of the new century. It's pretty heavy.
Yeah, it's people have been very generous to me, and I feel fortunate.
Rachel Kushner's latest novel, The Flamethrowers, is published by Scribner's. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.